Thank you, Council.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Last matter on the calendar is Davis.
Excuse me, I needed a drink.
Good morning.
Thank you. Something about adverse possession makes me dry-throated, so excuse me. Good morning. Patricia Novotny on behalf of Paul Davis. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. That might not have done the trick. Good morning, Your Honors. Courts here and around the country have for centuries declared in numerous cases that a defeated litigant has a right not only to a fair trial, but to the appearance of a fair trial. We don't want parties who feel...
Let me tell you something. We're real skeptical of this argument regarding the requirements for certification. What about public accountability contained in the Washington Administrative Code, which is a public document accessible to everyone? Tell me how the judge departed from that, looking up the law.
The judge didn't look up the law, Your Honor. The judge looked up a website. We don't even know what website
That's
the judge...
Find the law now, Counsel.
Well...
The only place you find the law now.
There is...
In many cases, including the Washington Administrative Code. I don't care for this argument, and I don't think
okay.
anybody else up here does either, unless you can say the website contains subjective information that departed from the actual requirements they relied on. You've got the CBA. I wish I had my own.
I can't tell you what the website contained because it's not part of the record, and we don't know what it contained because it's not part of the record. I don't have to make the record when the judge is injecting.
Well, I think you do with respect to having to show prejudice.
I don't think that's what the rule is. And here's my.
Ms. Novotny, just on that point very narrowly, didn't the judge offer to show counsel what he looked at?
He did, but see here, and I'll tell you why I think this is important. Why I would like to overcome your skepticism, because I don't think the rules squarely address this exact situation. And this case, and then talking around with people, I think has given rise to a great deal of concern on my part, and I think in doing some reading around in law reviews, that this has a tendency to kind of overwhelm the adversarial process, to skew it completely. I think this is a very compelling issue, and I think the analogy here, I don't think the rules map clearly, and I cited for you a bunch of cases from around the country where this has come up, and I dare say this is the tip of the iceberg, because I bet most of the time the judge doesn't do it right then and there or doesn't reveal it. But I bet there's a lot of this going on. And my concern, I'd like to talk first about just the trial-level activity, because I think there's some distinction between that and the appellate court activity. Though there's some problems there, I do think there's a distinction that we should bear in mind.
Ms. Novotny, is there any, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
yeah.
Is there a distinction, though, between what the judge did and if he just simply turned around and pulled the whack off the shelf and looked on the spot? What's the difference?
Well, under the rules, the judge, if he wants to augment his legal research, he's supposed to do that with notice to the parties, et cetera, under the rules. It's cited in my brief. I don't have it at the top of my head, but he can consult experts outside, blah, blah, blah.
I'm not consulting an expert.
That's well,
the confusion. Now, I agree with you. If we don't know what a judge looks at, that's not right.
Yeah.
If you turn around and pull the law book off the shelf.
That's not what he did here, though.
Consulting an expert. Well, then let's keep the argument confined to the point.
Okay, and here's my analogy.
Broad business.
Well,
what a judge can look up, which does these days, I agree, become highly problematic.
It's very problematic, and what's the difference here? And here's why I think the analogy is much better if you draw it to what if he had emailed a CPA who would have pulled the whack off or known about the whack. The website and the CPA seem to me a lot more similar than pulling the whack off of the shelf. And here's the other point that I think is important. This was not a matter of law. This wasn't a legal dispute in the case. It wasn't law that pertained to the judges deciding the case as a legal matter. It was a factual dispute, like the effect of a tax law or blah, 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 or the effect of, you know, in other words, laws are facts too. This was a factual dispute the court was resolving. By resort to a law, perhaps, but it's not the same thing as doing legal research on a community property issue or some sort of dispute where the parties engage in what the law, a dispute about what the law is. And I think that's an important distinction, and that's why this brings this more under the rubric of ER 605 than it does under judicial notice. The judge didn't do the judicial notice things. What the court did here is much more like calling a CPA, much more like those cases where the judge sent his clerk to the University of Washington to examine their policies, which for all I know are probably a law too. Under this, the University of Washington hospital policies are probably a law too. That doesn't mean it isn't wrong for the judge to interject himself in a kind of fact-finding. It doesn't matter, I think, that the law is the ultimate fact that's found. It was resolving a factual dispute right in the middle of my client's testimony. And I think that's why it's so important. Now, you know, I think that analogy not only works better, but I think it works better for an important policy reason.
Is there a distinction between legal facts and non-legal facts?
Not a clear one. There really isn't. You know, I read until my head spun, kind of, you know, law review articles and some treatises, and, you know, it's a subject of almost metaphysical debate. But I think when you take one step back from this and you look at it, my client's testifying about a factual matter. Can she get to be a CPA fairly soon? Yes or no? The law impinges on that, as it does on so much in our life. But it's a factual dispute. And the judge comes in and basically, you know, says, not only does he investigate then, but think about the impact on the proceeding itself and how it makes my client feel. He didn't go to the internet and look to see if there were jobs available for the wife.
For your time.
Let me finish this point, because I wanted to make the point about the policy. Because if I'm right that the rules don't map particularly perfectly on this because of this huge explosion in the internet into our lives, this huge invasion into our lives, then I think you need to read the rules in a way that enhances the integrity of the judiciary. I think you need to read them in a way that preserves the adversarial process, not only in fact, but in how it looks. And this looks bad to me. It looks bad to my client, who every single discretionary ruling in this case broke against him, and one that's not discretionary, the child support issue. And I think when he looks to an explanation for that and sees the judge moving in and doing the wife's attorney's job, that's what he sees. As his explanation. I'd also argue, and it's in my briefs, that on just an abuse of discretion, the maintenance decision is wrong, because under Dewberry, she doesn't get to just do what she wants and make him pay for it. She has to establish a need. So on that basis alone, we would ask for reversal. But thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. You have 3 minutes. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Valerie Villison for the respondent, Julie Davis. We're asking the Court to affirm the trial court's decision in its entirety and to award attorney fees to Ms. Davis for having to respond to this appeal. The bottom line of this case is that the trial court made a just, equitable, and wholly discretionary decision in awarding the wife 55% of the property, 2 years of maintenance after a 17-year marriage, during which time she was the stay-at-home mother, and also awarding child support for the party's 2 children, with whom the father has no residential time. What the appellant is doing here is, essentially, he's coming in with a Monday morning Hail Mary pass, alleging all sorts of constitutional violations and allegations of errors that he himself set up. On the appearance of fairness doctrine, I mean, he might feel slighted by what the trial court did, but that's not the rule. It's whether or not a reasonable person would have viewed what happened at the court to determine whether or not there was any fairness. And in this case, the trial court did exactly what it was required to do, and it was to take notice of the laws and the rules of the state promulgated by the agencies of the state. Counsel said that the parties had no idea what he was looking at, but that's not true. He specifically said what he was looking at. He was looking at the website maintained by the Washington State Board of Accountancy that has a Washington.gov address. That's exactly what he looked at, and what it has on there are what is set forth under the WACS 43070 and under the statute RCW 1804-105, the experience requirements for CPAs to be licensed. Whether it's a fact or law, this is the exact type of thing that ER 201 allows trial courts to take judicial notice of. It's capable of a determination whether it's accurate and a determination whether of its source. And again, the sources are the rules and laws of the state.
There were the second part to ER 201, taking judicial notice, requires an opportunity to be heard.
Correct. And if and they have an opportunity to be heard. They said even if the court, without notice, states it's like it's taking notice of something, the husband had an opportunity to challenge it, to say, well, you know, we disagree that this is something you could take notice of. He didn't do that. Instead, he waits till appeal to make this challenge because the fact of the matter is he cannot come meet the insurmountable burden he would have to show that the trial court otherwise abused its discretion. In terms of, you know, the maintenance provision, $3,500 a month for the next 2 years, possibly three at half of that amount. This man makes almost $14,000 a month. This is a woman, the wife, you know, the mother of his two children, who had not worked outside the house for the last 16 years. That's totally discretionary and well within what the trial court could have done, regardless if the mother went on to school like she did or if she, you know, tried to become a CPA, because she wasn't a CPA at the time of trial. There is an allowance under, you know, Marriage of Washburn talks about, you know, maintenance can be used to balance the standard of living between the two spouses. And in this case, she was coming out with, you know, no work experience for the last 13 years. This case is not like Dewberry. In Dewberry, the husband, a year before separation, was working in executive sales. He decided during the dissolution he wanted to be a longshoreman. That's not the case here. The wife hasn't worked for, at the time of trial, 16 years. So, you know, it was well within the trial court's discretion. And they've also raised, again, this allegation of an error with child support because they've only imputed her income at halftime. That was proper for two reasons. One, there was no evidence that she could work full-time. She was going to school full-time. She was caring for the party's two minor children at the time of trial. And she just could not work full-time. So the trial court did exactly what both parties, including the husband, proposed, that her income, in addition to maintenance, be imputed at halftime at minimum wage. There's nothing wrong with that. And this idea that we should be forced, that these parties should be forced to go back down to the trial court to litigate this, is wholly unfair and, and it's not practical. Especially if this was going to be an issue in the trial court, the mother could have made all sorts of different arguments than she did. The mother could have said that the father should have had his income imputed because during the dissolution, he chose to go from a $200,000 gross annual salary to $165,000. That was because he didn't like his job anymore. He thought personality-wise, it suited him better. But at that point, if we knew that child support was going to be an issue, the mother could have said, you should impute his income to what he can earn. Unless the court has any further questions, I'd just like to say you should affirm and award Ms. Davis her attorney fees for having to respond to this appeal. And also, I understand that you guys denied the court denied the motion to supplement the record. But unfortunately, it was not until after we spent most of yesterday trying to respond to it instead of preparing for argument. So we'd like our attorney fees for that as well.
Counsel, it seems to me there was an assertion that his health played a role in his change of job. Seem to be very dismissive of that.
I am dismissive of it because that occurred, the issue of his health occurred years ago, and at trial he was asked whether or not his bipolar disorder affected his ability to work, and he said no. I mean, the health impacts he may have had years earlier does not necessarily mean that during the dissolution, when they're getting separated and, you know, income now becomes a matter, that he can just choose to take a lower paying job. But the fact of the matter is, the wife did not make a big deal about it in terms of child support because they'd already agreed that his income would be at his actual income and she would be imputed at halftime.
Did the trial court make any factual findings about the relationship of his mental illness with his child support?
No. Well, and the trial court, no, because again, the issue of it being imputed income was not an issue. He wasn't imputed income. They used his actual lower income to establish child support. So the trial court didn't need to make findings at that point. But certainly if Ms. Davis is being forced to go back down to the child support to litigate this issue, that certainly will probably be an argument that could be made and probably will be made. And I don't think it will be satisfactory to Mr. Davis because, in fact, his child support will probably go up, not down. And again, this is a case where, their argument about child support is ludicrous, that somehow the mother is not providing support for her children because her income is being imputed half-time. The children live with her. Any income that she has is provided for those children, particularly because, for reasons, it's not clear in the record, the father has no residential time with the children. So she's responsible for every single day, every single hour of those children's support. If there's no further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
My client's health, his financial declaration makes clear is that he, as soon as his employer allowed him, found a place for him, moved him into one that was better preserving his health. And it's hard not for me not to get pretty angry about this because he is being held to such a different standard than she is. He's supposed to keep killing himself at his job, and she's supposed to be able to pursue his passions. So he has to put her through college. And the children thing, I have played by the rules about this. The court said the whole parenting issues were off the map, and they keep insinuating that there's some wrongdoing on my client's part about why he's not seeing his kid. And I've submitted in the second appeal the GAL's report that says it's her abusive conflict that is the problem. And he just backed off because he didn't want to hurt the kids. And I just really feel outraged about his treatment by her. And let me just say this. I know a new trial is a huge, big deal for everybody. My client doesn't want to pay for that either. But this maintenance award in and of itself is wrong. She is getting a pass. And, you probably are aware that I feel like equal rights for women is a good thing. But I don't think that is at the expense of treating men fairly. And I think that's what happened here in respect only to the maintenance award. And that goes for fees, too. You cannot manufacture need. You look at the statute, talks about your age, your experience. She's got 2 degrees. She's got employment experience. She could get back into the job market. She's in her 40s. It's just not fair. And the court is the child support. The court has a separate duty to approve that. You can't agree to come in at a lower child support, something other than the statute mandates. But let me say my last minute, the thing about the appearance of fairness. And the problem is not what the court found. It's what the judge went, that he went looking. And I think sometimes, I know in my role as a teacher at the law school, I often forget that however benign I know myself to be, my students are often scared of me. And I think judges too. You have so much authority. People come into court and they're afraid of you. They're afraid of what you can do to them. And I think, ER 605, with its recognition that you don't need to make an objection when the judge interjects himself, and 201, the evidence rule, yes, thank the opportunity to be heard, you're going to put that burden on my client to just tell the judge, bad on you, judge, I want to have some time for this. That's not respectful, I think, of the role the judge occupies in this courtroom. And I would like you to reconsider my motion on the supplemental evidence. I had no idea that stuff was out there. It took forever to find it. But I think it, for me, explains why the judge went looking. I think the judge wasn't impartial here. Consciously or not, he was allied with counsel for the wife. And for that reason, we'd ask for some relief in this case. And certainly no award of fees to the wife. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. That concludes the calendar.
All rise. We'll be in recess.
I know.